So what I want to talk about is, yes, a circle of results, which are now rather old, but perhaps not so well known. The problem of prescribing and finding hypersurfaces in space times with prescribing curvature. Okay, so let's start off with a little bit of background. I guess it's all background that depends on your point of view. So we're looking at space-like surfaces. So for example, in Minkowski space, we're just looking at the graph of a function over the x Rn. And we'll assume that the surface is space-like, and that comes down to the condition that the gradient of u be bounded by 1. And you can see that by looking at the area of M. Let's see where that comes from. It's square root of 1 minus the u squared. And if you know the minimal surface theory, if you're looking for a minimal graph, it would be the same. The area would be 1, but now instead of minus, it would be plus the u squared, square root. And that gives us a very different flavor. So, first thing we want to do, or the first problem that one comes to, is looking for critical points of this functional. So if you're ever trying to maximize it or minimize it, then you go looking for critical points first. And this leads us to the variational problem. And you'll see that I've included an extra term here, which has the effect of saying that the mean curvature, which is what arises in the Euler-Lagrange equations, comes out to be the function little h. So we'll be looking at maximizing, and why is it maximizing rather than minimizing? Well, you can always choose u such that its gradient is almost everywhere 1, and then the area term vanishes. You can't push down any lower, so the minimization problem is fairly trivial. Turns out the maximizing problem is much better behavior.
Robert, well, I think if you use the pointer, you will eliminate the buzz.
Oh, there's a buzz there. Oh, yes.
Yeah, we're getting the buzz.
Way
on the right hand side.
Thanks, Gary. All right, so now the front. Oh, that's why there's no one sitting in the front row. So we have the Euler-Lagrange equation. You do a variation of this and then do an integration of parts, and we'll end up with the divergence of gradient of u normalized by this factor, and it'll be equal to mean curvature function h. So the Dirichlet problem will be to solve this equation with the boundary conditions. Now, the two problems are not the same, because the set that we maximize over for the variational problem includes functions for which the Dirichlet problem of this operator here is not well defined. So we could possibly have solutions of the variational problem which are not solutions of the Dirichlet problem. And it turns out to be a major part of the work. So we can...
I just want to understand that last point. I mean, is that just an issue of regularity that you point out?
Not necessarily regularity. We'll see that, in fact, actually, it's possible to prove that solutions of the variational problem, with one exception, at least away from some clearly defined singular set, will be a solution of the Dirichlet problem. That is, that the gradient of u will be strictly less than 1, which is the critical point, of course. Sorry about the pun. Okay, so this one's for the graduate student. This is how I learned differential geometry, basically. I did a lot of calculations with hypersurfaces when I was young. So, there's a number of things just to make you feel at home. So a graph. Tangent vector, well, it's a tangent to the graph, so you go along in the x direction, you have to go up in the dt direction. That gives you the tangent vector to the surface. Now, from that, of course, you can take the inner product of this with x sub j and get the induced metric. We get this minus sign coming in here again. And then you can determine the determinant of this. Lo and behold, it's this factor 1 minus the u squared, square root for the volume. And the inverse, well, you can also go ahead and invert this matrix. You get something which looks like a minimal surface thing, except if you're in a minimal surface, you'd have a minus here and a plus here. There's always this swap going on. And you'd have a very different set of equations. So then you have the normal vector, basically in the time-like direction with the correction term, basically like shift. And then there's a normalizing factor, which is our old friend 1 minus the u squared again. And I'll give it this special name nu because it turns out to be extremely important in the analysis. And then we have the extrinsic curvature, and I don't know why I call it k. Normally I'd call it a. I'm calling the extrinsic curvature, so k is that all right. So the standard formula says you just take the second derivative position vector and dot it with the normal vector and get the normal vector's got this component here, so just getting u times the second derivatives. And the mean curvature, mean extrinsic curvature, is just going to be tracing this with respect to the induced metric g up by j. And here we see the original expression coming up that we had in the previous slide. Now, you can expand this out. You're going to have a Laplacian term and some correction terms. And what you're getting out of all of this, that's a fairly simple exercise, is that this expression here, well, with a factor of 1 minus the u squared, 1 on, is the Laplacian on the surface M of the height function u. I won't say too much about the flat space results because they're pretty much all subsumed within the full space-time results, but I should say, at least at this stage, that fairly complete existence theory was worked out by myself and Leon Simon in the flat space case, and what I'm looking at here is really a generalization of that, So the starting point is to assume that we've got a space-time which admits a time function, that is a function whose gradient is everywhere time-like. I guess that means it's oriented, time-oriented. I'll effectively be assuming throughout those some variations are possible, but everything is in sight is globally hyperbolic. That'll do for the time being. So gradient is going to be past time-like, so we can normalize it to a future unit time-like vector t by a normalizing factor, which is essentially the length of the gradient, the g upper tt. And the mean curvature, this is the direct analog of the identity we had on the previous page, the slide, at the very bottom, where this term here is set to 1, and this term here is the divergence of a space-time vector. This is parallel in the Minkowski space case, so this divergence will automatically be 0. So the important thing that we've derived is the restriction of the height function of the time function to the surface is this height function u that appeared over here in the definition of the mean curvature. And we have the analog of 1 on square root 1 minus the u squared is the space-time inner product between the two time-like vector fields. The reference back one, if you like, this is dt, and the normal vector to the surface. Future mean normal, this is minus sign. And a very important formula now comes in when we look at the variation, in particular the second variation. We know that the first variation of area is essentially the mean curvature. That's where it came from. The second variation says what's the second derivative of the area going to look like. And that's down to the first derivative of the mean curvature. And if you write this out, this calculation, which I'm not going to do here, what we find is, well, there are various different ways of writing it. In particular, this can be turned into a difference of scalar curvatures, which is very important in other problems. The process is not so important. Just, yeah, comes up, for example, in the some COVID action causing some construction and so on. But the important part about this is that we see here that we have something which is essentially, if we choose X to be the variation vector field X, be the time translation T, that what we have here is the Laplacian of the tilt factor. So from this formula, we get a formula for the Laplacian of the tilt factor, the gradient, 1 over 1 root 1 minus mu squared, in terms of length of the extrinsic curvature, Ricci curvature, the second derivative of area, or the first derivative under the variation of the mean curvature, and the tangential correction term. In fact, this term could be subtracted from this one and derived an expression involving just the normal derivative of the mean curvature function. That's a little bit more convenient, at least for the applications here, particularly this one. Okay. Yes. This last term here is, of course, something that if you want to use this formula for calculating the Laplacian, you're going to have to somehow get some expression for this term here. Everything else is essentially controlled by either the space-time geometry or the geometry along the hypersurface. But this piece here is going to give us some problems. It's not one that would occur in the flat space case, for example. However, there is an argument. That is the following. What it is the derivative of the mean curvature under a flow. So if that flow were an isometry, then the mean curvature wouldn't vary at all, so therefore it would vanish. So what that means is that that expression should be equal to something involving the killing tensor of the deformation vector. Turns out that there is such an expression. I did this one a long time ago, I don't remember how I did it. But, well, it comes down to a calculation. You just can't hide from it. You just go looking for the derivative terms at every stage. You see traces over the surface, components in the normal direction. So we have two gradient pieces, derivative, so that's the second derivative, and the second derivative here. And then first derivative terms involving the extrinsic curvature. The important point is that with X being some reference, not even necessarily time-like vector field, we have a way of calculating this which is going to involve terms which are all controllable in terms of background geometry.
So, what is X in the formula for derivative of H? Are you sure?
Well, there are different ways of writing this. It's the following. You've got a surface. X is a vector field, think about a transverse to be on the safe side, and it moves the surface. The mean curvature then moves. The X derivative in the X direction of that mean curvature function. So if you think about S as being the deformation parameter, then I should have said at S equals 0. Then that explains this side of it anyway. Okay, so let's see how we use this. In order to proceed any further with the mean curvature, we've seen already that it's basically an elliptic operator. The trouble is that it's not uniformly elliptic. And in order to apply the DeGeorgian Nash-Moser framework for estimates and so on, it's necessary to have a uniformly elliptic second order operator. And that means that the coefficient term, that is the G upper IJ, has to have eigenvalues bounded above and below, strictly greater than zero and strictly less than infinity. Now, G upper IJ, recall, so a lower bound is not a problem. This matrix has the lowest eigenvalue being equal to 1, the upper bound is going to be a term which is the u squared on 1 minus the u squared. Well, actually, it's just 1 on 1 minus the u squared. And that's going to be unbounded unless we can get control. And that's what I mean by gradient estimates. I want to try and control the slope, the gradient of u, less than 1. So, a little bit of background, we can do deal, as it turns out, in the argument with mean curvature functions, which are far more general or more complicated than just constants, zero. So rather than constant mean curvature, zero mean curvature, we'll look at prescribed mean curvature, where it not only depends on position, but it also depends on the normal vector. So this in particular allows you to look at mean curvature problems where you're defining with respect to a conformally related metric, where the normal, where this vector comes in naturally into the mean curvature. So there's a very general set of structure conditions. Basically says that this function here is, say, C1. C1 function on the tangent bundle. Okay, now, what I claim, or the first real result, is that it's possible to derive a priori estimates for the tilt function, or if you like, the u, 1 minus the u squared, in terms of the oscillation of u, and a constant which depends only on the C1 and C2 bounds. In particular, it does not depend on the size of the domain. So there's no Sobolev constants and so on which would depend on the size or geometry of the region over which we're working. This constant here only depends on supernorm estimates on coefficients. And similarly, if we have boundary, I should have said, yes, here we have it. Assuming that on the boundary that u is actually equal to 0, then we have a similar sort of estimate involving oscillation and so on. Now the constant will depend on a little piece of extra information, that is the mean curvature of the boundary. That's a codimension 2 surface. You estimate it with respect to a fixed background frame. That's what I mean by these double bars everywhere. Just to be able to estimate things in terms of some reasonable quantities. So how do we do this? Well, it's possible to do this via integral estimates. This was done by Klaus Gerhardt and also myself and Leon Simon in the flat space case, using Moser iteration and Stampacki lemma, if you pass Gerhardt. But the maximum principle works much better. So let's at least see it in summary. I'm not going to go through all the details, it is a bit of a mess. So what we do is we look at the test function, where we've got some large constant k, which we're going to specify. It's determined in terms of the constants bound in the geometry that we've seen already, plus the logarithm of mu. Now, u is 1 on the square root of 1 minus the u squared, so it's always greater than or equal to 1. So log of u is a function which is greater than or equal to 0. Okay, so this stage it starts turning into a lot of fun. We say, well, supposing we're at a maximum point. And at that point, we know that the gradient of this function is 0. Well, we're assuming we're at a maximum point which is not on the boundary. If it's on the boundary, then we have to do some separate arguments. So, we're at an interior maximum point. We know the gradient of f is 0, and we know that the Laplacian of f, and this is really quite elementary, is going to be less than or equal to 0 because it's just a maximum. So it's negative. Alternatively, if we're at a boundary point, and we know that tangential to the boundary the gradient is 0, and normal to the boundary, n being the outer normal, the function is increasing. So let's come back to this. This is going to give us, once we substitute back, two relations. One which relates the gradient of nu to the gradient of u. Now the gradient of u, I don't think I said, but it's... u squared minus 1. So an upper bound on the gradient of u squared is the same as good as an upper bound on the gradient on u itself. Modulo lower order terms, which we don't care about. So this piece here, which is what we're going to ultimately want to try and control, is going to involve this piece here, which is completely hopeless. And now we come to the second derivative, the Laplacian term. I've written down a substitution here. I've substituted for gradient u. This expression that's given was the term in the middle. We've got a Laplacian u term, which we're going to have to handle. There's a term over here, which is essentially the mean curvature. So we're going to be able to absorb that. And we'll notice that which is the best term here of the ones we've got. Well, it turns out there's one here that will be good. But the ones that this term here is the one that really counts. Because later on we're going to make k very large. Very large, well, it doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative. This term is always going to contribute a very large negative amount to the inequality. And that's going to be good for us. Okay. So we can basically throw this guy off against the mean curvature and throw it away. So the passing u is going to be essentially bounded by geometric constant times u squared. If I come back to the formula for the Laplacian of nu, we've got, recall there was a nu times the length of the second fundamental form squared, now called a. Then there was a term in the Ricci curvature times nu, and there was that horrible term in the time derivative, the nt by the s and hs. But that can be all estimated in terms of geometric quantities and terms which are no worse than u cubed and u squared. So these terms here are going to be bad terms, but somehow we're going to be, turn out we can absorb them all. Okay, now there's a little bit more we can do. That is, we recall that the gradient of nu is essentially a term like, say, the tangential direction. It's a term involving the normal vector. So this is going to be basically a second fundamental form term. Pieces that we don't really care about. So this tells us that this piece here can be controlled in terms of a second fundamental form. In particular, it can be controlled in terms of the largest eigenvalue of the second fundamental form. And that's this formula here. This is the largest eigenvalue plus or minus of the second fundamental form. And the important point is because we know that the trace of the second fundamental form is controlled at the mean curvature, so it's essentially zero. That means that we can control with this not only the eigenvalues, but a little bit more. As it turns out, it's 1 plus 1 on n. So I've given up a little bit more to take care of the junk terms with the Peter Paul principle. So I've given up a little bit of my 1 on n, but I still have this positive piece, strictly positive. And this 1 on 2n is the key. Make the argument work. So this gradient u squared we didn't really want, as we saw before, but we can throw it off against gradient u squared. And now what we see is a large term, large power, and this is essentially a u squared term, is bounded above. So we're controlling a piece that we want to control. So this now tells us, maybe we get this last step. Somewhere we got this last step, divided by nu that was control. Yes. Yeah, that's right, we took it. One piece. That was what control the AC. The bit that's left over here, this 1 on 2n, goes into the formula. Everything else turns into error terms of order u cubed. This counts as one factor. And what that means is this term here is basically u squared, so it's a u cubed term. If we make k large enough, this is going to swallow this term up. And what we get is that the gradient of nu is less than or equal to a constant, which we can make potentially even less than 2 if we wish. And that tells us that at the maximum point, if we choose k sufficiently large in terms of geometric quantities, that this term here is log 2. So that tells us that at a maximum point, this function is always going to be less than k times the maximum of the oscillation plus a constant plus 2. Thereabouts, 1. And that then tells us that at any other point, f is less than this quantity, and that's giving me the gradient bound that we wanted in terms of the size of u. So that's the gradient bound in this case. The boundary maximum is a little bit more complicated. First of all, one assumes that u is at 0 on the boundary, and that's an interesting assumption. And then if u is 0 on the boundary, then either k is plus or minus will give us an estimate. So the only case that we have to consider, really, is where the maximum point is on the boundary, and it's the maximum point for both this function, the other function. And now what it comes down to is basically analyzing this very carefully on the boundary, using the fact that on the level set, the mean curvature is there, so you can analyze the Laplacian view quite carefully. I'll pass on the details of that. Anyone wants to work through it later on? So the end result of this is that we have uniform ellipticity under many general conditions. And as a result, we can solve, it's not really quite as trivial as I make it out here, using the theory of second order quasi-linear elliptic PDE, we can show that the solutions are uniformly elliptic, and then we can show existence. And the sort of results we get, just representative here, supposing we specify a boundary manifold, we put in the condition that it bounds a strictly space-like hypersurface. That turns out to be important, otherwise we clearly could not solve this problem. So this is clearly a necessary condition, and the statement, the theorem is really showing that it's a sufficient condition. And a reasonable mean curvature function, as we've discussed. And there exists a hypersurface with this boundary, with the prescribed mean curvature, function f restricted to m, and there you have it. Now, what did I leave out? I left out something, and that is the condition that m is compact. And this is where some of the interesting things start happening. I'll come back to that in a little while.
Yep.
And about this time, what is the time function? That's only what is assumed?
The time function has assumed already, yeah.
But that's all. Any space-time with time function?
Yeah. In particular, there's no mention of the Einstein equations, which is really quite disturbing. But there it is.
Why should the Einstein equations have something to do with whether you can solve this problem?
Well, they do come up in other situations, at least partly. This is the so-called time-like convergence condition that I'll come to. So you might believe that somehow they also had something to do here. Other geometric problems arising, such as the positive mass theorem, and the Einstein equations on strain of inequality, so energy conditions are very important. But it turns out not to be the case in this. So now we can look at coming back to the variational problem. In space-time, you have the area of M as a space-like surface. That is a space-like, I'm being here weakly space-like, or a coronal. Surface. We can seek to maximize this functional over all competing surfaces M, M tilde. By competing, I haven't been very explicit, but because of various counterexamples, it's probably best to say that they can be joined by essentially a family of T translations from one surface to the next. And moving along the interval curves of some time-like prolongation, thereby constructing diffeomorphisms between the competing surfaces. It's necessary for some peculiar reason for those examples where the surface flows, comes around and comes back over itself. So the result is, and this is not something I'm going to talk about the proof at all, that there exists a surface M which satisfies, which maximizes this functional. It's strictly space-like everywhere, except on a particular singular set. So strictly space-like means that its gradient is bounded and nice and smooth, smooth as the data will allow. The singular set, however, has the property that it's composed of the points on null geodesics, where the very precise geodesics, such that those null geodesics have end points on the boundary of N. Now, it's clear that, so I'm supposing that's our boundary sigma minus one, and there's two points here, which are connected by a null cone. Then any surface, a causal surface spanning this, is going to have to include this line here. This is slope one. So the variational problem will have solutions which satisfy the variational problem and satisfy the Dirichlet problem only in away from this singular set. Of course, most of the time in most examples, the singular set will be completely empty. So the point is examples can be constructed where it's non-empty. So, for example, if you have a Cauchy surface which is compact when the singular set is not there, is not present. Okay. So, what do we know about uniqueness? Well, uniqueness results are, I must say, not particularly encouraging. The best we have is really the Brill-Flaherty argument. It basically says that the mean curvature should decrease to the future. I'm using normalization, which says that my hyperboloid, R31, that's T is equal to root 1 plus S squared, the mean curvature equals T, 0. So you can take a pick as to which normal vector convention you wish to take.
Does this use Einstein?
Oh yes, this certainly does. Yeah. It certainly does, because what it comes down to is the second variation of Arkley. You look for a maximizing geodesic between the two surfaces, and then you calculate the second derivative of the length as you vary it in the direction normal to the geodesic. Then you take a trace over the frames normal to the geodesic, and you get the second derivative is less than or equal to zero because it's a maximizing geodesic, largest distance, and it's equal to a Ricci term plus a mean curvature, a future mean curvature minus a past mean curvature. And this will always have to be less than or equal to zero. This is positive, so therefore this piece here is going to have to be negative in any physical situation. So if you know that this piece is H1, you have a greater mean curvature here than here, then this gives us a contradiction, so this can't happen. So the mean curvature to the future is less than the mean curvature to the past. If I got that right. What more do I need to say? Well, this holds clearly if we are looking at compact hypersurfaces with which are Cauchy surfaces. If they have the same boundary, then the same sort of eigenhold. All you really need is that there exists a maximizing geodesic between two points of the two surfaces.
If the time-like convergence conditions is not satisfied, I mean, are there examples?
Oh yeah, plenty of examples. You can take any De Sitter, for example, as the standard sort of model.
De Sitter, you mean?
Is this a De Sitter? Okay. In this case, you've got boost, which can bring you up to here. They've already got non-uniqueness. You can also translate here and decrease the mean curvature. So there's lots of non-uniqueness. Yeah, so clearly, it is the case that uniqueness is not true in general.
And then becomes an interesting question to deal with. And I have a great deal to say about that, unfortunately. Okay, so using the maximum principle, we get the idea of a crushing singularity. So this idea goes back to Eardley and Smarr back in the 70s. It was used by Klaus Gerhardt to prove that there exist foliations. So the idea is that we have a sequence of surfaces all moving to the future, and the mean curvatures of them getting more and more negative. What this means is that given any prescribed mean curvature, constant, bounded at least, we just take k large enough that it's going to lie, have mean curvature strictly less, and then we use that as a barrier to the future. And this allows us to derive, to control the one piece that we don't have, or we haven't had so far, in the gradient estimates. The gradient estimates, you'll recall, all depended on the oscillation of u, that is, its maximum value minus its minimum value. If you're on a compact region, the light cones don't tilt too much, then that's control. But if you are on a non-compact domain, the light cones tilt over too much, then you can't control the height. And one of the ways of doing it, controlling the height, is by assuming that one has these sorts of barriers. There are situations which have these. For example, in the Kerr solution, the interior singularity at r equals 0, is a future crushing singularity for the future part, and likewise for the r less than 2m to the past of the bifurcation surface. And similarly, we can talk about past crushing singularity. So one consequence of this is that one can assume that you have, say, a space-time with compact slices, or even the non-compact space-time, and control the height by these barriers. That is, the iteration the variation procedure which produces the solution basically starts from a known solution to a known equation and gradually turns out all the nonlinear terms on. And as long as that can be done in such a way that the mean curvature barrier condition still holds, the solutions as they vary will always stay between the barriers. In the future and the past, Cauchy surface barriers in this singularity. The end result is that you get a height bound, a uniform height bound, and that's enough to ensure that you've got gradient bounds, infinity bounds, and therefore, by a Scholtz-Zeller, you have convergence. Okay, so this says the result then is. Klaus Gerhardt, for example, is that if the time-like convergence condition is satisfied and we have future and past crushing singularities, then there exists a foliation by constant mean curvature surfaces. Yes. So, now there is some problems with this, and that dealing with the Schwarzschild. Because the Schwarzschild singularity, if you like, is actually not compact. So I think there are ways in which that can be reworded so that it still fits, but there still seem to be, believe it or not, some real problems with Schwarzschild. Okay, another situation where the height bound comes in, or is extremely important, is the situation where you want to look at maximal surfaces which are asymptotically flat. So assume we have a space-time which is asymptotically flat, space-time which is asymptotically flat, smooth, asymptotically flat in the sense of decaying down to, say, Minkowski, which is faster like metric, with a large r. 10 is a largish number. And in the interior, we'll assume a bounded geometry condition. Now, to be explicit, bounded geometry is not enough to say that we've got, say, control on the curvature quantities. But we also require that another boundedness condition is satisfied, which says, if I look in the interior region, so this is r equals 10, I take any point along here, and there's a fixed constant such that regardless of this point P, the height that can be reached starting from this point P is no more than less than or equal to fixed constant C. So that is another way of saying that is that the light cones don't tip over too much. So for example, one way this could go wrong is if you had a picture like this, you've got peak here, and you want to have as a time like a space like curve. Where the light cones start tipping over. And that's exactly what happened in the Schwarzschild case. In the Schwarzschild, so we're looking at the region, let's see, yeah, let's suppose we're down here, looking at a space-like surface. The space-like surface can go off in this direction, and it can rise as high as it likes in the time-like direction. So this interior, this surface, this R equals 10 surface here is not very good, not very useful at controlling the geometry in the interior, and we can get this blowing up behavior. This was first pointed out by Brill in 1982. So we put in the bounded geometry condition just to ignore this, to overcome this problem. We're still left with the problem, however, of the exterior. And that's also quite easy to see. So let's suppose we know what's happening here. We solve on a large radius, much, much bigger than 10. The solution may want to go up for a long way and then come down again. Well, that's okay. But now if I go out to even further, I might decide that it wants to go even further. And every time it gets higher, the estimates get worse. So in the end, you've got no height estimate and no gradient estimate and no hope of controlling, extracting a subsequence from this family of solutions. So what's needed is something to control the height here. And, that was tough. Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe if I just summarize what the idea was, at least. It's a fairly familiar technique in PDE, called the method of test functions, but you can see it in the following way. Supposing you have a U maximizes its own variational problem, so that is, this is greater than or equal to, same thing but evaluated for V. Assuming V has the same boundary conditions as U. This is the same U. Now if you swap these two around, so this is just saying that U, if you like, is a maximizer of the variational problem for this mean curvature function. And therefore, in comparison with any other test function V, will give us something which is less. This is maximum. So if we swap the two things around, we end up with this quantity should be less than or equal to zero. Now you can actually prove this directly, I won't go through the argument. It's not very difficult. And what that tells us is that there's a difference between h of u and h of v. So for example, supposing this one has mean curvature which is slightly negative, and this one has zero mean curvature, that's essentially the situation we find ourselves in, then u cannot get too positive. Because if it does, then this whole thing becomes positive by contradiction, and we have a contradiction. So the idea of the proof is already sitting in this very simple identity from the Minkowski space. So let's see how we do it. Well, we solve the Dirichlet problem on finite domains. That's not a problem. But nice convergence there because we have a uniform height height bound at each fixed R, so we can get convergence for any fixed R and we can find our solution. And then we want to, shall we get convergence uniformly, as R tends to infinity. So we need to say that there's a uniform bound M such that everything lies underneath this. And then one can derive convergence to understand measuring methods. So now the trick is to basically say, well, that's the identity that I want. I'll let this be a radially symmetric solution, which is essentially this guy here. I'll show you this explicitly in just a minute. That produces a negative 1 on R cubed. Of course, we're going to have heaps and heaps of junk terms. So this is basically this term here. That's the mean curvature which we want, which is 0, so we kill this. And we put in a test function, and we do an integration by parts. We end up with something which says that the maximum view logarithm, and where the logarithm came from was the 1 on R cubed here, and the fact that we're integrating on a region where R is at least halfway out to infinity. That's far enough out that we can get a bound on the maximum view. And thus we have the existence of a global solution. Now the problem with dealing with extending this to the general case, like for example when you have Schwarzschild in the middle, or even if you have, and this is kind of embarrassing, you have a boosted set of galaxy or something like that moving past you at something not speed zero, then if you like the existence of boosted cells. In all of those cases, we don't have any estimate at this stage of the height which we can use to then control the convergence. Yes. Maybe there's some way of doing it via interior estimates. Okay. So this is the maximal slices in asymptotically flat. A couple more entertaining topics. We'll be done. First is removable singular points. If I look for solutions, so this is a height function, W, I'm thinking about it just as a function of R, the radial distance in Rn. Well, I'm using n equals 2 here. So n equals 3, this is n minus 1. Then we can solve this explicitly. We get an arbitrary constant k, positive. We know what W is, the integral of this. So this is always a little bit less than 1, so it comes in quite rapidly by the power of 4 here to the light cone, but then it's spaced like everywhere else. As we vary k, of course, we get a family of such surfaces, all which have zero mean curvature, except at this point here. They're called singular points. Now these are reliably informed Born infill particles, or Born infill point singularities. Electrostatic solutions. So the question is, first of all, does this behavior persist in non-flat? The answer to that is yes.
Just showed in a paper published in 1987.
I also showed that there are situations where this sort of singular behavior doesn't occur. That is where, more than that, supposing I have a point x equals 0, where I get something which looks a bit like this, but it doesn't come in tangent to the null surface, the light cone. Let's suppose it just stays a little way away from the light cone. That's measured by this parameter delta here. So it's within plus or minus delta of the light cone. That holds for all x in the interior of the ball, around the point. Let's suppose that we have, say, mean curvature being constant. And in this case, it turns out that, in fact, the surface is removed, the singular point is removable. That is, that instead of having a sort of a squashed cone type picture at the center point, the solution has a smooth tangent plane, and therefore becomes a classical solution
of the prescribed mean curvature, constant mean curvature equation. So that's basically using a lot of constructions involving constructing foliations and comparison against foliations using the regularity theory just on small sets. So there are two applications of this
I'd like to mention.
The first is what I call condition G. And that says, suppose you've got a cosmological space-time, there's a point on the space-time such that its future is past basically fill out the whole space-time eventually. So if you go far enough into the future, I plus will control everything. And the easiest way of saying that is you take the space-time, you take off I plus point P, and you apply this in compact. In an argument of Gerosch originally, though we didn't have the regularity theory like this movement singularity theorem, shows that if you look at the class of all surfaces passing through this point, and look with to find a constant mean curvature surface by the variational formulation, for example, so you look for a constant mean curvature surface which passes through this point and is everywhere else going to be smooth. Now this corresponds to a boundary point. There's no condition in the boundary analysis which really says that you need to have a lot of regularity on the boundary, so a point will do, particularly for the variation. Then, at this point, by using barriers of this form, for example, you can find that there are three types of behavior to the solution at this point. You can either come in tangent to the future light cone, as in the model singular problem, or it can come in tangent to the past light cone, of course, or it can come in through a smooth plane. And then basically a continuity argument, comparison with a background foliation again, shows us that there is going to be at least one mean curvature for which the surface is regular. Has a tangent plane at this point, and that's the constant mean curvature surface that Gerosch asserted exists.
Robert, did you also want to remove I minus of P there? In...
Oh, yeah. I should point out that the G is one-third Gerosch and two-thirds Greg Galloway. So the corollary to this is that because once we have a constant mean curvature surface, it's either zero or it's positive or it's negative. Now, either positive or negative, then we know that we've got a conjugate point within a finite distance and we have geodesic incompleteness. If it's zero, then we can do a perturbation argument and find constant mean curvature surfaces nearby, just by the implicit function theorem. And then they're either zero mean curvature or they're constant mean curvature again. So the splitting corresponds to the case where the constant mean curvature slices one constructs through any point of zero mean curvature maximal, and therefore totally geodesic, or we get the geodesic incompleteness. So this is, I guess, a baby version of one of the splitting.
So what condition is on the Ricci tensor?
Ricci tensor has to satisfy the time-like convergence condition. Otherwise, of course, you'll get counterexamples.
You said the barriers come from of the background foliation, so which?
For the crushing singularity? Or for,
well, for the existence of this constant mean curvature.
Oh, in this case, no. So we do this because we know that we've got compactness. So the high bounds are not a problem. It's really cheating.
That's where the compactness comes
from.
So the condition is precisely the barrier.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's all of it. Okay, let's see. So I should the list of open problems. I'm sure that there's plenty more that people have looked at, I'm not aware of, but I haven't said anything, for example, about exact solutions of these, constructing exact solutions in R21 and R31, for which there's been a lot of work. So one of the things is, being a little bit euphemistic here, I've never been able to check all the details of this paper, and I'm not sure that anyone has ever, possibly except for the Puritans, checked the details of that one. So it would be good to have the coordinate conditions clarified. In particular, they should be clarified in such a way that one can apply the same techniques to the Schwarzschild space-time, space-time with boosted slices, space-times with Weiser-Nordström ends, for example, and so on. And, it's an interesting analytic problem, but it comes down to ultimately being able to control the height. And there's, well, the original argument was extremely bizarre. Not very common. So trying to generalize it is still to my mind, a major problem. One other one which I haven't listed here, but also here, is the question of coming again to this question when the time-like convergence condition fails, and that is showing that even under those situations, that it's possible to find solutions with constant mean curvatures. Not only find solutions, but find foliations with constant mean curvatures. There's work, for example, explicit calculation by Marcus Heinzler and Bobby Baig on finding such solutions in Schwarzschild integers. Okay.
Regarding junction, people use calibrations a lot to obtain results.
Yeah.
Is there an analogous construction?
Well, to some extent there is, and the idea of calibrations is you basically just set up a foliation, and if you've got something that comes in there, then it's controlled by the foliation. Of course, there's much more that goes on here, but at least at that level, that idea was used a number of times, the singularity removal with filling in gaps and so on. Having said that, though, I guess calibrations in general are not so uncommon, but the way they're used in general, in most cases at least at present, is in very symmetric cases. So I guess that's not true of Kalman manifolds, which are a lot more complicated. I'm not sure that doing it in... I'll pass. Possible to buy the I mean, basically, these things like the divergence of the normal vector. It's likely that it will just come down to the techniques that I'm using here. There are some tools, tricks, or so on, which aren't being used here, which I haven't mentioned. In particular, there's the proof of the Bernstein theorem by Calabi and Chen and Yao, which is based on the properties of the Lorentzian distance function, which is basically 2m. Which could perhaps give some additional room, and also the formula for the Laplacian of the length of the square, the length squared of the second fundamental form, and that's also used in the Bernstein theorem. But it's I haven't seen it being used in the gradient estimates or height estimates or anything like that. It's another interesting. Certainly extremely important in minimal surface regularity.
Have you thought about how to produce open sets of spacetimes which don't have any CMC surfaces, just without imposing any energy conditions, just purely kinematics?
That's a short answer.
You have one example, right, which is very special now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly you'd have to believe that it's true. I mean,
you have to believe that they're open sets with no CMC?
No, there are open sets in some topology on the space of space times, which I guess you'd have to formulate, but you know, C100 or something like that would do.
Why do you have to believe that?
Well, it's
small perturbation of the metric is not going to change the mean curvature by very much. In particular, if you're away from critical situations such as Ricci curvature vanishing and second fundamental form vanishing, the type of geodesic, if you're away from that, then you also know your linearized operator is invertible. So you should be able to get nearby C and C for that in problems. I guess I'm beginning to wonder what's motivating the question.
Is it obvious? Okay.